Greetings. You're listening to Exploring Boys Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC that examines current issues affecting boys, teachers of boys, and boys' schools. I'm Tom Batty, Executive Director of IBSC, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to Season 7 of a series that is masterfully coordinated by IBSC Director of Membership Engagement, Bruce Collins. In this first episode of this new season, Bruce interviews Melinda Baguana, Specialist Environmental Educator in the Junior School of Trinity Grammar School in Sydney, Australia. At the recent IBSC Annual Conference in Boston, Melinda was awarded the 2025 IBSC Action Research Award for her innovative action research project that focused on junior school boys co-creating green spaces for well-being. Within the broad topic of boys and belonging, facilitating inclusivity, diversity and connectedness, her research project took a unique and refreshing approach to explore how boys designing and constructing an environmental project together created a band of brothers united by purpose, shared experience, and the magical sense of worth that flows with discovery and recognition of individual talents towards the group solution of problems bigger than any one member of the team. I had the privilege of seeing Melinda's project on the ground at Trinity and found it inspiring, convincing, and with an infectious draw to be involved and learn. Also joining Bruce are Corey Brown from the Haverford School of the United States and Di Laycock, IBSC Action Research Programme Coordinator. Corey, Melinda's Action Research Team Advisor, will highlight what made Melinda's project worthy of the Action Research Award. And later in the episode, Di will share information regarding the new Action Research topic, Future Frontiers, Fostering Boys' Learning in the Forward-Thinking Classroom. Applications for this new cohort are now open, and more information can be found on the IBSC website. Before handing over to Bruce, take note that in September and October, we have two online classes and various ideas lab groups starting. Now, over to Bruce, Melinda, Di and Corey.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be back. And we're talking about one of my favorite topics, which is the IBSC Action Research Program, as Tom said. Corey is one of our Action Research Team Advisors. Before we speak to Melinda, I just wanted to hear from you. What was it about Melinda as a researcher? What was it about her approach to the theme of boys and belonging? And also her final project for you who worked so closely with her. What was it that stood out on all those levels?
Right from the get-go, Melinda really embraced the IBSC Action Research Program. She conducted rigorous research, she crafted a really thoughtful action, and she connected really authentically and deeply with her team of boys school educators from around the world as they swapped ideas and they supported one another throughout the process. There were two things in particular that really stood out to me about Melinda and her project. And the first was her desire to fully understand the boys in her care and to fully understand how those boys connect to each other and connect to the world around them. So instead of starting from the research on belonging, she started from the boys. She talked to them, she asked them questions, she listened to them, and together they identified the different layers of connectedness that help her boys feel a sense of belonging. And then, only then, did she start exploring each of those layers of belonging in the literature. And she used those layers to help her design an action. The second aspect of Melinda's project that really stood out to me was how thoroughly she activated the local and global communities to which the boys belong. So when she was conducting her research, she did not only read about belonging, she actually reached out to and interviewed a leading scholar on environmental youth activism. activism and told her about her project and got feedback on her project from this leading scholar. She brought in ecology specialists. She brought in an Aboriginal elder. And these people worked directly with the boys as they cared for the land and created the pond. She involved her entire school community. She worked with the teachers, the psychologists, students in multiple grades. She basically activated her entire school community. So with all of these different components, it's no wonder that her results were so fruitful, that the boys not only experienced a greater sense of belonging in each of their layers of community, but they also ended up experiencing a greater sense of responsibility to those communities.
I think you've set us up for a great conversation about Melinda's project.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Mel, I want to welcome you to Exploring Boys Education. What a delight it is to have you on to share more about your project. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation today.
It is my absolute pleasure, Bruce. Thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of the project you did, the biodiversity pond, all of those things, I'd love you to give some context about yourself. You know, what is your journey into the space as a specialist environmental educator? And what sparked your interest, particularly in this whole idea of boys and their sense of belonging in a school space?
Well, Bruce, I was really fortunate to grow up in Sydney, Australia, and my backyard was this beautiful nature reserve, and it really developed my love for the environment. It really gave me a childhood that was deeply connected into nature, and it connected me into nature. And after high school, it led me into studying a degree in landscape architecture, and then I went on to some further studies in urban horticulture, and from that they asked me to come and teach, and that led to a 30-year environmental teaching career at the University of New South Wales and also other tertiary education settings. And I also ran my own landscape architecture practice, where I got to design residential parklands, rural estates, and even larger recreational spaces. So That was very important. And then when I became a mother, I had two boys. So boys are particularly close to my heart. And of course, my love for the environment flowed into their childhood as well. And I heard about this incredible job going at Trinity Grammar Junior School for a specialist environmental educator to sort of be part of their International Baccalaureate Primary Youth Program. And when I heard about it, I thought, wow, that's a job that's designed for me. I'll get to teach boys out in creation, share my passion for the environment, my love of nature. And this time, instead of university students, I'd get the opportunity to be able to teach these boys sustainable learning life practices at a much earlier age. And now it's 4.5 years since I coined the program, the Green Patch Initiative, and it's been the best professional challenge of my whole teaching career, but also my career as a landscape architect. And what I love most of all, that it aligns so perfectly with Trinity's mission of growing good men. So, yeah, it's been a beautiful journey to get here.
I'm excited to talk about the Green Patch. You've mentioned it. I love that name, the Green Patch. Maybe as we get into speaking about your project, you could share a little bit about the Green Patch contextually, how it fits into Trinity Grammar's sort of school context, and what makes it a really special place for your boys?
Well, Trinity Grammar School, our main campus is in the inner western suburbs of Sydney in a gorgeous suburb called Summer Hill. It's only about 8 kilometres, 5 miles from downtown Sydney's central business district. It sits on Wangal country. That's the Indigenous people that own our land. And our junior school runs right along the northern boundary of the senior school. And here we educate about 300 boys from kindergarten to year 6. Where it was developed, initially they gave me this little paved courtyard, probably the size of a tennis court, and I said, I need more space. That's certainly not enough for 300 boys to do what I've got cooking up in my head. And so we were able to then spill out to a very long lineal space along that boundary that was a disused space that the boys were not allowed to access. It was out of bounds for them. Really what it is a detention basin that fills up a little bit during high rainfall events, but it became this space where we removed all the boundary planting and screening and opened it up so the community could see into the space and the boys could also interact with their neighbours. A lot of people walk their dogs past, they have little chats to the boys, and it's really been a beautiful connection point with the community. And having an outdoor classroom is very special for the boys.
Mel, you know, when it came to your actual research project as part of the IBSC Action Research Program, your action was quite ambitious, you know, getting these...
That's what I heard a lot.
26 boys aged 7 to 12 to design and build a biodiversity pond over 8 weeks. I mean, that sounds like a huge thing. Maybe you could briefly walk us through what that process looked like. I think we can learn a lot about the process and how your conceptual model, you spoke of a spiral of connection, guided this journey in the creation of this space.
Well, first of all, the design side was done in term three. So I got back from London having learnt how to run an action research project, which was fantastic. And I thought when I spoke to my Green Dreams boys, they're my co-curricular boys, on a Tuesday afternoon, and I said, I really want to do something special. And they had just finished creating their little mini wetland, and they dug and there was mud everywhere. They just loved it. And they said, can we please do the frog pond? And so that frog pond became a biodiversity pond. And term four was the construction stage. And as you said, yes, it's ambitious. 26 young men organized into this space. And because the lunch club, and that's the time we were going to do a lot of the building, is very popular. I actually got the school psychologist and their class teachers to see which boys would benefit most from participating in a project on building the pond and having a greater sense of belonging in the school. So that ended up being 12 year three, four boys. They were the younger boys. Then we had, from my Green Dreams after school co-curricular club, we had the 14 year five and six boys. Those older boys became the mentors of the younger ones. And then I had two that then served as the media crew. So on a Tuesday afternoon, the older boys would learn what construction skill they would need for the next lunch to lunch times. We then meet on a Wednesday and a Thursday, and we 12 boys on each day, and then they would build together. And then we had our two little media crew filming it all. So I've got lots of footage, and it was an incredible thing to do. And to work out what they would do over those 8 weeks of term four, we formulated what's called a schedule of landscape works. That's what a landscape architect would do to help the build stay on time and know what was going to be required and how to plan for each week. And then you just spoke of my conceptual model, that the spiral of connection. Again, I always love to have my boys fully connected to these projects. So again, when I came back from London, we looked at another brainstorming session, looking at what potential forms of connection might occur in a project like this. And we came up with these six themes. And again, I'm going to paint a little picture for you here. The spiral starts with the word connect in the middle. And then out from that came my research question, which was, how can a student-led environmental project foster connectedness in junior school boys? And from that, we started with layers building up from the first beautiful connection that our Indigenous people have. They have this innate connection to country, and that is cultivating kinship with the land. So it's a very intricate system of stewardship. And from that layer of the land, then we looked at their green patch, so their special connection to place. And because they have been part of creating that place, their green patch from the start, they have a really special attachment, and it means a lot to them. It's the sense of place is strong for them. So from that connection to place, then we moved on to looking at the connection to nature. And from that, how could we cultivate a greater sense of biophilia, which is a love and a nurture of nature? And that didn't take much. Being in nature is just a beautiful thing, which I'll talk about later, but that connection and that love certainly grew, and it had a lot of positive effect on their psychological well-being, which of course then led into that connection to well-being. So it had that beautiful cultivating their physical, emotional and social wholeness, which was a beautiful way that impacted each boy's worth and their value. So that lovely sense of well-being, then that led to the connection to community. So cultivating that sense of belonging, because community and being part of a community is such an important part of it. So it was building relationships with each other, participating in that patch community, and then moving into the greater school community where everybody was able to have this space as part of their lessons, and what they were creating was going to enhance their lessons. And then also, as I said before, when they talk across the fence line and they educate the local community. The final piece was their connection to healing our planet, which cultivated sort of a hope-fueled sense of solutions, and it also started to connect them with like-minded projects, and that then built a collective responsibility. So, yeah, it was an incredible little thing that kept developing, and drawing up the graphic was just a really special thing to capture it all in one diagram.
Yeah, as I said earlier, people are going to have to access your report to really dive into that. It's fascinating for me. And apart from the findings we're going to speak about now, about boys and belonging, what a gift it is to these boys to have had and to continue having that experience of real world thinking, which is really what we want for our boys, isn't it? One of your key findings was that the project strengthened the boys' sense of community and belonging, something you've already alluded to. You know, you saw new friendships form across your groups that carried from the green patch into the main playground. You know, how do you think this shared, purposeful work of building something tangible, like a pond, forged those powerful connections that you saw develop in the boys?
First of all, there were so many new friendships that forged throughout this project. We had a lot of year 3 to 6 boys that had not necessarily connected before. They do a lot in their cohorts at school, but going down between year 3 to year 6 through those sort of levels, because they had this common goal that they were working to and they had a very intense time over those 8 weeks, it was a really incredible way for them to connect. And so we would start each session where we'd sit around the table. I called them table communities, and they'd sit, they'd eat, they'd have lunch together. They'd start these beautiful connected conversations. And Niobe Way was a really important resource about boys and their different ways of connecting, their curious listening skills. And that really inspired us to for them to learn about each other. They found that they had some common interests, and that then built bonds over time, and it made them feel seen, it made them feel valued. It was really a beautiful way for them to connect. And I think I said before that purposeful work where they worked side by side constructing something that was pretty special.
And I think you alluded to something else around boys' well-being, which is something I'd like to explore. You know, in your project, you note that some boys find the playground overstimulating or a space like the library too restrictive. And I love that, you know, some of the findings of this project show that this initiative had a remarkable impact on their well-being.
Mm. Well, nature does have such an incredible restoring effect. I mean, I love that word recreation, recreation, because spending time in nature restores our souls. I've got this favorite verse, and it says, "Speak to the earth and it will teach you." And nature teaches us so many things, but possibly the most beautiful thing that nature teaches is that it nurtures our internal landscape. And nature's got this incredible power to help control our cortisol levels. It lowers them. It reduces cognitive overload and stress. It assists in emotional regulations and helps us cope better in stressful situations. So really, nature's the ultimate brain break. It restores our minds and it turns off our involuntary brains. It resets them. So when it comes back on again, when it turns back on, we've got that beautiful increase in focus and attention. And it does something to really improve negative emotions. One of my boys, he nearly blew me away with this comment when we were doing our reflection, our exit interview, and he said, I used to think about all the negative things that happened in my day, but after building a pond, I now think of all the positive things. And so I said, oh, that's going to make me cry because it's really affected them that deeply. And wow, as an educator, that was so beautiful. And to see them go back after lunchtime when they'd had that, I sent them better equipped to learn because they'd had that restorative time, and it really was a gift to their well-being.
It was fascinating for me as I read your project to see this post-project shift that, and it's particularly in the boys' favorite activities, you know, moving from simply digging to being actively involved, like you alluded to questions back, you know, the sense of ownership and connection. And and I think one of the things that was most likely a really successful part of this project is how much ownership you gave them in terms of creating.
Yeah, I think when they have ownership over something, it really does enhance that sense of responsibility and that connection to space, that place that it's our place. I think I one of them gave me a quote and it said it's our place. It's a place of comfort, kindness. It's relaxing and fun in nature, and it's full of biodiversity. So they love this space and they want it to thrive. And that's part of their flourishing. When they see their space thrive, it makes them thrive. And that desire to nurture, it shapes them as caregivers, and that's a beautiful thing. And I had somebody once say, what you're doing in the patch is actually going to make them become better fathers because they learn how to nurture and care and steward. And that was particularly special. Even my role as their sort of nature mentor and again, me imparting my love for nature and my wonder and awe that I find in the natural world then leads them on to lifelong connections. And I think that is one of the most important things, that they had connection to a cause, that, and that then enables them to be able to take action. Not only have they learnt all these new skills, but they then can form their own environmental solutions to creating habitat and developing their own deep emotional connection with nature that has that lifelong connection and develops that environmental stewardship throughout their life. So that was a very important part of the project.
Mel, I'm fascinated by some of the other lessons that come out of the project. You mentioned earlier this connection between older and younger boys, and I think those of us who have worked in boys' spaces for many years can acknowledge the power of that kind of mentoring relationship.
Well, most of these boys that signed up for this, that we sort of encouraged to connect with us for the project, aren't your normal leaders. They're not the boys that get the leadership roles in general. And so it was a deliberate action for these boys to be able to look after the younger ones and mentor them to build not only their self-confidence but the younger boys' self-confidence, to impart those leadership skills in them, to learn how to build relationships not only with the peers in their cohort but to their mentees that they had to look after. And that, as I was saying before, created a band of brothers. And so this little 26 group of boys had this lovely nurturing effect on each other, connecting those, you know, the down the levels and up the levels. And I found it built quite a lot of empathy and humility in the boys, because and possibly a bit of empathy for me as well, because in the exit interviews I was saying, well, what was it like being mentors? And some of them would say, oh, look, they just wouldn't listen to me. It took me weeks for them to learn to listen to me. And I said, oh, well, that sounds a bit familiar, boys. they got a taste of what leadership's like, and it's not always an easy thing, and you've got to sometimes find common ground where you can connect with these boys and they will start to develop that respect. And, you know, some of them almost idolized their older boys in the end, and it was just beautiful to see boys that hadn't had roles like this before, really, again, that there's that word flourishing, because I saw them rise up and they became very proud.
I was interested to read, you know, you use the climate emotions wheel, but there was a shift, almost a rising in anger-related feelings in the boys, such as outrage and frustration about the planet's health, which, you know, obviously we want eco-warriors out there, but how did you see that those emotions turn into something hopeful and positive?
Well, when you talk about hope, that's what so many of them put initially when we pre-project. We got them to look at the climate emotions wheel and just with a little sticker on the wheel, stick where they felt that they, how they were processing their climate emotions. And so many of them put hope down as their initial findings. But as the project progressed and through their lesson times, I was teaching them more about the climate crisis. So I realised that they moved from being blissfully unaware and, oh, yeah, everything's hopeful, we love the green patch, the world looks great. Once they were educated and started to learn of some of the things that were resulting from the state of the environment, and that our country and many other countries' leaders were not really stepping up and taking action as quickly as they should be, that was also putting back the way that our climate and our Earth could be restored, that it gave them feelings of heightened anger and outrage, and I thought, oh wow, this is a bit of a worry. But thank goodness I do that literary review, Bruce, because it helped me, you know, reading upon what other people had found out, that these negative emotions don't always, and I found this, they didn't result in negative outcomes, that these emotions acted as that catalyst to move them into activism, and it built the confidence in them and a self-assurance that they could make a difference.
I would love to speak about a lot more, but we're running out of time. But I do want to ask you to reflect a little on both the project and the future.
Well, the thing that I loved most of all about action research is that it is such a dynamic process, and there's no definitive endpoint. I will keep going and going and going, and it will continually help me come back and reflect to where we're up to. It's a really special way of having done a project. The co-teaching model that we have in the Green Patch, I always have the class teacher because I'm not a trained primary teacher. They're always with me, but that's very special too, because not only do we need having 25 boys in the classes in the patch at any one time, having their teacher with them in a different context to the, you know, their traditional classrooms, having them outside working side by side with them, enables them to have conversations that opens up a whole new level of relationship. And it's really special. I learn from the classroom teachers, they learn from me, we learn from the boys. So that has been a very special way. And it's deepened the connection of the classroom teachers with their students as well. And it brings both the boys and the teachers this highly valued, concentrated time. And so these interactive and inclusive learning experiences really speak of that into their worth and their value as well. And that's one of the things I desire most, is to make each boy feel special, feel that they're valued and that they do make such a contribution. That's the Green Patch is beautiful in that respect. I call it it's the echogenic effect, where you might be a sporting champion, or you might be the scholarship winner in the music, or you might be the ducks of the school. But when you come into Green Patch, it's a level playing field and everybody's equal. And nature has that leveling effect, and being able to immerse the boys in that is just beautiful. To have them be able to sometimes wander and just potter around and look at the details of nature, and just have that time to connect in a space that's, they're not being examined, you know, there's no assessment. It's just a time to be free. And our boys need that more than anything in this world, where everything, every moment of their day has been planned out, to be able to come in and immerse in this space and just have that beautiful connection is, I think, one of the things that I've actually doing this project has highlighted to me, just how important it is for our boys to have that time and that space.
This time that I've spent with you has been inspiring, Mel, and I want to thank you for just your generosity, not only your time, but also just so generously sharing your insights and the lessons you have learned. And I just want to thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, thanks, Bruce. It's been such a delight. Thank you so much.
Who better to have on the podcast to highlight what's in store for the next cohorts of researchers than IBSC Action Research Program Coordinator and all-around research guru, should we say, Di Laycock. So Di, the 2026-27 IBSC Action Research Program theme, Future Frontiers, Fostering Boys Learning in the Forward Thinking Classroom. Sounds really, really exciting. But I'm wondering if you can break down what a forward thinking classroom means in this context and why this theme is so critical for boys' education today.
Look, firstly, the term forward thinking is an apt replacement for the phrase 21st century, which has really been used for some time now to describe the desired knowledge and skill outcomes in the teaching and learning landscape. However, we are a quarter of the way through that century, and given the plasticity of the educational environment, it's more appropriate really to avoid a time-stamped label and instead use flexible and dynamic terms such as forward-thinking or future-ready. So the theme of the forward-thinking classroom was chosen because action research in this area will help address, certainly at the local level, a question that many, if not all, educators are asking. And that is, how can I work to ensure the students I teach have the skills, the knowledge, and the wisdom to successfully navigate, both individually and socially, the frontiers of a rapidly changing environment and an uncertain future? And while these needs apply to all students, the shift to recognise skills and competencies beyond the academic are particularly relevant for our boys, who research shows can struggle with the development of soft skills and who are underrepresented in workforce growth areas such as the care sector. So to me, that phrase, forward-thinking classroom, it really describes an adaptive teaching and learning environment that is really catering to the challenges of rapid technological change, the demands of a shifting workforce, economic disruption, and global issues such as, you know, climate change, social inequality, and geopolitical instability. At a broad level, the emphasis in teaching and learning praxis in the forward-thinking classroom is really about encouraging students' learning through flexible pedagogies that foster deep learning and student agency. We really want the boys we teach to be able to learn deeply and independently by developing their skills and competencies to take the information that is now everywhere and so readily available and to interrogate that information by internalising and contextualising it to become personally useful knowledge. But it just doesn't stop there either. We also need to go one step further and enable our boys to develop the wisdom to make sound decisions by applying their knowledge ethically, judiciously, and insightfully.
So, Di, specifically, what skills are desirable to achieve these outcomes?
The research points to the need for schools to facilitate the development of students, what we call transversal skills. And that's a term I'm using broadly here to incorporate not only practical skills, but also values, attitudes, and beliefs. They're skills that enable effective action in virtually any kind of work, any kind of learning, or any kind of life activity.
Di, when we think about moving from skills to strategies, what strategies might teachers consider using to facilitate the development of the forward-thinking classroom?
Well, look, I think if we are talking about enabling student agency, then we really need to place the emphasis on flexible pedagogies, by doing things such as incorporating real-world problem-solving, technology use, activities that encourage global competence and transliteracy.
If you had to consider the commitment involved, who would the ideal educator for this action research program be, and what might the most significant long-term benefits for both the participant and their school be?
For the participating educators, and I'm using the term educators, not just teachers, because, you know, we have a range of people who are not necessarily just all the time teaching in the classroom. You know, we've had topics where we have sports coaches, school counsellors, and so forth. So we've had reflection statements from some 500 graduates of the program, and they indicate the career-changing power of action research. Action research has provided them with the insight into the importance of engaging in evidence-based practice and the need for them to constantly reflect on their classroom practice to ensure that the ever-changing needs of their students are met. As well, conducting an action research project has certainly inspired quite a number of researchers to step into further study, a postgraduate study. And yet others have really used their research experience to raise their profile within their schools, because they go back and they're presenting their research to the school. They're taking quite a leadership position within the school. Schools have also benefited from having a staff member complete the program. And while researchers' projects are often undertaken with a small number of participants for the direct benefit of the researcher and their students, the projects often serve as trials for possible changes to practice and programs at a school-wide level. Furthermore, the researcher has the skills that they've developed through the program to lead school-wide change, and to enable that the effects of that change are rigorously studied. I've not met a graduate of the program that has not reaped some benefit of their participation for their own practice and for the performance of the boys they teach.
Di, I think the only thing left to say is to folk who felt excited about what you have shared and have always wanted to apply to be part of IBSC Action Research, the applications are open. Visit theibsc.org for more on Action Research and the many professional development programs currently on offer. Thank you so much for listening. And until our next episode, keep on championing boys' education.